You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. The migrant caravan at the center of President Trump's fevered warnings over the course of the past week got its start on October 12th in a city in Honduras called San Pedro Sula, where it seemed to take little more than a flyer and some Facebook posts to conjure it into existence. San Pedro Sula is the country's second largest city. It has been a flashpoint of popular resistance and repression in the wake of a military coup in Honduras that ousted center-left President Manuel Zelaya. It's also where our next guest starts her book about post-coup Honduras. Dana Frank is a professor of history at UC Santa Cruz, Emerita. She's been doing research on unions and social movements in Honduras for almost two decades. Her forthcoming book, The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. Dana Frank, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
I want to start with what's happening right now and then kind of work our way backwards into the history and the bigger structural issues driving people to leave Honduras. So what do we know about the genesis of this particular caravan?
Well, the answer is we don't know very much. We do know it was not organized by the opposition, as the Honduran right has been claiming, and as the Trump administration has been claiming that. We know that it was some people that were at the San Pedro Sula bus station and were trying to get on buses north, and there wasn't enough room, and so they decided to form a caravan and were talking among themselves. People do regularly go in small caravans for years in order to get across Mexico safely. And I think people, as far as we know, people just started sharing news about it on WhatsApp. They're looking for a way to be able to travel north safely without being preyed upon along the way. And so I think it certainly had nothing to do with the timing of the U.S. midterm elections. And people start going on caravans this time of year after the rainy season ends and the rivers drop. So that's another precipitating factor here. There's also been terrible floods in Honduras in the last month, so that made people even more impoverished.
But in terms of scale, it's far bigger than any previous caravans. It started as 160 people. By the time it hit the Honduran-Guatemalan border 3 days later, it was 1,600, now reported to be in the vicinity of 7,000 in southern Mexico.
Well, certainly within Honduras, people knew about the caravan in March, so they don't know exactly how many people did or didn't get in. But they know now about the whole concept of a big caravan and its possibility to protect people. So I think that means that it spread faster. And also, people have thought about it. You know, they're so devastated. They don't have the money to pay a coyote to get them across the borders. And they're every day they're more impoverished and more threatened by organized crime and the gangs. So and the lack of health care. So they've been thinking about it. They've had the time to think about it. They obviously knew all about the caravan in March and are looking for a safe way to not die and to keep their children from dying.
Tell me about the city where it started, San Pedro Sula.
Well, San Pedro Sula is the second largest city in Honduras. It's the industrial capital of Honduras, or it used to be before CAFTA and the destruction of much of its industrial base, but in recent years. But it's a very interesting city. Tegucigalpa, the capital, is the more intellectual and political capital, but San Pedro Sula is the capital of the North Coast, which is where the banana unions, workers' unions, have been militant and strong since the 1950s. So it has a long history of lockdown, serious struggle, and political consciousness. It doesn't get a lot of attention. It got attention starting in 2012 as having the highest murder rate in the world. And as far as we know, those murder rates are still top international statistics. I wouldn't believe a word the Honduran government says about the murder rate having dropped. We only have those statistics from the government itself.
Mm-hmm. San Pedro Sula, also one of the principal sites of protests after the coup against Manuel Zelaya in 2009.
Absolutely. I mean, when Zelaya was overthrown in a military coup on June 28th, 2009, this tremendous, broad, unified opposition movement rose up all over the country, and San Pedro Sula was one of the biggest centers of that. In fact, there were road blockages in Choloma, which is right outside San Pedro Sula. It's where the biggest clump of a maquiladora or export processing factories is, and people blocked that highway. The big highway is sort of the equivalent of blocking I-5 as it went on the road to the port. They blocked that over and over and over again and were brutally pressed and beaten up, and famously police kidnapped and gang-raped a young woman, and they pulled her out of that one of the demonstrations.
So how did San Pedro Sula go from being the center of resistance to the murder capital of the world?
Well, people are resisting the very processes that have made the murder rate shoot up. So the coup led to, the coup itself was a completely illegal act and by the military, but also approved by the Supreme Court and the majority of Congress. So the coup completely threw out the rule of law. It so itself was a criminal act, but it also just opened the doors for this spectacular corruption of the judiciary, the police, and the military. And it was a then and since, it's a free-for-all of corruption and criminality. So that means that you can basically kill anybody you want and get away with it. And that's been true for nine years. In that context, every kind of criminality and murder just shoots out the ceiling. That's why people are resisting this government. And, you know, the other factor in this is the political party Libre, which has a strong base in San Pedro Sula and is the center-left party that came out of the resistance to the coup.
How much of a relationship is there between organized crime, gang activity, and the government?
That's a great question. We don't completely know, but it's very clear that there's collusion, particularly in drug trafficking. You know, without going down the road of the militarized drug war, it's really important to underscore quite how much drug trafficking is interlaced with the very top of the government. Current President Juan Orlando Hernandez, or I would say current dictator Juan Orlando Hernandez, and we can talk about him. You know, his brother is charged with drug trafficking. The Minister of Security and Defense, who's in charge of all the police and the military, Julian Pacheco Tinoco, has twice been named in U.S. federal court for overseeing drug flights. The national director of the police, the number two director of the police, and number three, all appointed in January, have been documented by the United States, have been documented by the Associated Press to be involved in cocaine trafficking. So we're talking about the very top of the security forces and the police and the military being involved in drug trafficking. Now, that's the drug side of that. And, of course, that world of drug trafficking at the level within a community means that if you resist something that the narcos, the drug traffickers, want you to do, you're going to be killed. And they kill people routinely for those reasons. Then there's the gangs that overlap with the drug traffickers and are sometimes rival to them. And the gangs operate at a local level but are also interlocked with the government. They're also more interlocked with the police, locally with the police. And just to give an example, a lot of what the gangs are involved in now is extortion. So if you have a small businesses, and I certainly know people that have small businesses, and the gangs come around and say, give me $75 a week or we'll kill you. And if you make the slightest peep objecting, you'll get killed. And if you report it to the police, you'll get killed. And here's an example in the town of La Lima about 2 years ago when the extortions moved in. An old man protested to the police, protested to the person that came around to collect his payment that he was sick of paying this and he was an old man. And a few days later, the police and military completely disappeared from the town that they'd been patrolling. And somebody came and shot him, and then the police and the military returned the next day. You know, you can see clear collusion here. There's a case of a barber who was shot and his assistant that were shot by gangs, and because he right before that had reported the extortion to the police. So obviously the police knew that he complained legally about the gangs. So you can see that kind of connection going on there. But, you know, at a big level, it's important to ask the question, well, who's the gang here? And I talk about this in the book. We talk about gang activity. It's really, a lot of people say, well, it's so terrible. People are fleeing drug traffickers and gangs. The big gang is the Honduran government that is interlocked with this, that's countenancing this, that's created this situation in which the judiciary and much of the government are corrupt. And in that context, it's not just that they profit from the gangs, which is not the main thing that's going on here. It's that they are creating the context for the gangs to flourish. So when people say, oh, people are fleeing gangs and violence in Honduras, they're not natural disasters. It's not like somehow Latin Americans are naturally violent, which is the other sort of racial politics can feed in here. It's a human-made disaster by a government that is itself criminal and tied with drug traffickers, and that itself is also has created this context in which this kind of danger flourishes.
Is it strictly at the government's feet? One of the things you chronicle in the book is a long process of dismantling social programs and state programs at the behest of the International Monetary Fund.
You know, absolutely. And of course, who controls the International Monetary Fund? The United States, and we can come back to that. The IMF or the International Monetary Fund has poured literally hundreds of millions of dollars into the post-coup government. And you can see key moments when they coughed up money. For example, when Juan Orlando Hernandez was first running for president, you could see suddenly there was $200 million that went from the IMF to a program called the Bono de 10,000, or the bonus of 10,000, which is basically $500 payments to poor people for a stove or a piece of a roof. And the Univision did a really great story about how this is a vote-buying operation. And you could see that it was poured in to support his campaign. But at a deeper level, the IMF and other multilateral development banks support two things. One is the destruction of state services and this dismantling of the state. So, you know, for example, right now the electrical system, the state-run electrical system, is being taken apart and private and first stage in privatization. If you read the Honduran newspapers, the first headline most days is what parts of which cities don't have any electricity right now. But also the steps towards the destruction and privatization of the National Health Service, and just general assault on state jobs. There's a quote that I have in my book from the IMF saying, we're helping the Honduran government lower their wage bill. I mean, that's very bald about let's lower the wages of have fewer employees and lower wages for government employees implicitly. Now, the other thing that the IMF and the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank back is a model of economic development that is very, very destructive of jobs and livelihoods, that funds things like palm oil plantations in the Awan Valley, taking over campesino land and collectives and small farms and replacing them with giant palm oil plantations that destroy the environment, have very few employees, and are viciously imposed by a combination of state security forces and private actors. So that IMF model of development, it also goes into hydroelectric dams and mining projects that are directly assaulting indigenous land rights. And out of that, it's one of those struggles. People probably have heard of Berta Cáceres, the indigenous environmental activist who was assassinated on March 2nd, 2016. She and the Lenca people were engaged in fighting precisely one of these hydroelectric dam projects. So the IMF is involved not just in gutting state services, but in destroying people's livelihoods.
Yeah. We're speaking to Dana Frank. She's a professor emerita of history at UC Santa Cruz. She's been doing work in Honduras since 2000 and is just out with a new book called The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. The coup in this case is the military overthrow of the elected government of Manuel Zelaya, a political figure from a center-right party who was turning into something of a leftist in his first 3 years in office. And much of the story of the caravans leaving for the United States now are the story of what happened to Honduran society since that coup. So all the things you were describing, the poverty, the exploitation by gangs, the corruption at the government level, these surely were present to some degree before the coup. What was the extent of the change? What was the nature of the change?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I do want to underscore there's no golden age before the coup, but there was a functioning state. For example, there was a National Health Service that people that were in the formal economy went to, including middle-class people, and that has been devastated since. You know, there was something more of a functioning industrial economy, and there wasn't this level of repression of journalists, of human rights defenders, and protesters. I mean, maybe 10 to 20 people died for political reasons of being on the opposition in the 10 years before. And now we're into the thousands since the coup. You know, that the repression of the opposition is first and foremost the biggest difference. But also, you know, to a certain extent, although there were gangs, there were drug traffickers, there was corruption in the sense of people in the government just stealing money, the scale was nothing like it was after the coup. I mean, immediately after coup, the post-coup de facto regime of Roberto Micheletti, they just completely robbed the teachers' pension fund, for example. In 2013, the president and the ruling party stole as many as $90 million from the National Health Service, and the Attorney General has confirmed that those documents that prove that are real, and he's never been prosecuted for that. So this hand over fist, raw, just stealing all over the place, and we have this, fake NGOs that stole money from all kinds of government agencies since the coup. That's new. The gang the extortion of by the gangs is very much new, and actually it takes a few years to kick in. It starts around at a really big level, more around 2013, 2014 is when it really takes off. That's new. There was always connections, we think, between drug traffickers and the military that goes way back to the Contra War in the 1980s. But the level at which all bets are off is really new since the coup.
You described the current president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, as a dictator. Why? Tell us who he is.
Well, Hondurans have been using this phrase for several years. Juan Orlando Hernandez was a member of Congress from the ruling party, the National Party. At the time, it was not the ruling party, but it's now the ruling party. He is one of the two right-wing parties that have ruled Honduras for decades and decades. At the time of the coup in 2009, he was a member of a congressional committee that approved the coup. The unconstitutional military coup. In 2012, when he was president of the Honduran Congress, he led something called the technical coup, in which 4 out of 5 members of the constitutional part of the Supreme Court were deposed completely illegally in the middle of the night and replaced with people the next day. That's the so-called technical coup. So after that, he controlled the Supreme Court. We don't know whether he actually won or not the election in 2013, but after he was inaugurated in 2014, that Supreme Court, in turn, ruled completely illegally that the Constitution didn't apply when it said that re-election of a president is illegal. In fact, the Honduran Constitution very explicitly says not only can a sitting president or vice president not run for re-election, but that it's even illegal to even discuss or promote re-election by a sitting president. So he's criminal for that. So then he runs for re-election anyway.
There's extraordinary irony here because, particularly in U.S. media accounts, the justification for the coup against Manuel Zelaya might have been building a case for
revising the
Constitution.
And I want to underscore, and I say this in the book, there is zero evidence that Manuel Zelaya was trying to get a second term. The pretext for the coup was a ballot measure the day of the coup in which people would have voted yes or no, do you think that we in the future should elect delegates to a possible constitutional convention? And then that was used to say, well, he's doing that to get a second term. So, but Juan Orlando Hernandez, so your question is, why is he a dictator? First, he controls the Supreme Court through an illegal coup. We call it a technical coup. He illegally ran for president. That's the second thing. He controls the Attorney General, and the Attorney General, Oscar Chinchilla, was the fifth member that wasn't overthrown, and he was then named the Supreme Court, then was named Attorney General after that in an illegal selection process. And he was just completely illegally reappointed to a second term of 5 years. So we have an attorney general who is loyal to the president, sitting on all kinds of evidence in all kinds of cases, including Berta Cáceres' case, including the killing of 22 people, at least last November and December, protesting the most recent elections. And obviously, if he's supposed to uphold the rule of law, why would he accept his own illegal reappointment? So the president also obviously controls the police and the military. There's nothing left. It's not like you can go petition your Congress member. I mean, the National Party, the president's party, doesn't quite have a majority in Congress, but it rules with the Liberal Party, which is the other traditional right-wing party, and they have swung their votes in many, many key votes in support of the president. So there are very few breaks on his power except people from below. Now, last November, he was an illegal candidate for president, and the opposition united both the Libre Party, which grew out of the resistance, and a new party and a new candidate named Salvador Nasrallah, who was sort of a wild card centrist. They united, and Nasrallah was the presidential candidate, sort of the center and the left, more or less. And when the election results started coming in, when 57% of the votes were in, the Honduran government shut down the computers and then didn't release the rest of the data over the course of the next week and a half, and then suddenly decided that Juan Orlando Hernandez, surprise, surprise, had won re-election. So he's currently president by having stolen the election. It's widely understood that way. The head of the OAS at the time said, we think there should be a new election.
OAS is the Organization of American States.
So we have somebody who has imposed himself through a stolen election. Now, 100 people at this point were both very experienced in protesting and like, oh, you know, just full of grief and rage about what about the election being stolen so baldly. It was so very clear that Nasrallah had won, and they poured into the streets really beautifully and really made the, in many ways, this country ungovernable for a while through peaceful protests and road blockages. And the Honduran government responded with vicious repression using live bullets for the first time. Even after the coup, the Honduran police and military didn't use live bullets. So it was clearly an order that came from the top. Between 22 and 44 people were killed by the police and military, but peaceful protesters and bystanders, and nobody's been brought to justice for that. So that's a context that people are fleeing in terms of how do you protest. And people in Honduras that are fleeing in the caravan, they know this whole story well. They are the victims of this repressive government that is very scary.
How's the government of Juan Orlando Hernandez responded to the caravans?
Well, the main response has to completely falsely accuse that a man named Bartolo Fuentes organized it, and there's no evidence to that effect. Fuentes is a former Liberty Congress member who has accompanied caravans in the past as a journalist and helping people out, but clearly has started before he was even there. You know, but it's a way of demonizing the Honduran opposition. So now it's escalated to official government documents, both from the president and other top government officials, saying that the opposition organized the protests and that they're disloyal, and also trying to say that Bartolo Fuentes is a criminal human trafficker, so criminalizing. Trying to leave the country in a very dangerous way. And that discourse of it's the opposition that organized it has now converged with the Trump administration, saying that it was the both Pompeo, Secretary of State Pompeo, and acting U.S. Ambassador to Honduras Heidi Fulton have made statements in the last week that the political opposition organized the caravan. And this is a kind of demonization of the legitimate opposition, criminalization of the legitimate opposition that's been going on ever since the coup.
I've also seen the kind of reverse conspiracy theory. This is from people witnessing what an incredible election year boon it has been to Donald Trump to have this caravan as a foil. And the somewhat mysterious origins of the caravan, I mean, it really just seems like a couple Facebook posts and a flyer. No organization taking credit, no clear leaders. Suggesting that, you know, it was political operatives from the United States trying to start a caravan out of Honduras.
Well, of course, we're all wondering that, and there's no evidence to that effect at this point. People do leave in caravans this time of year when the rivers drop. So, and they leave in caravans all the time. I wouldn't take much for someone to figure out that it would be a good idea to fan the flames. It's possible that it was just a random caravan, and then as it starts moving through Guatemala and Mexico, then it would be consistent with what we know about other social media type campaigns that they grew so rapidly, especially within Mexico, because somebody might have conceivably been encouraging it because they saw that this could be a potent and is a potent political weapon in the hands of the right, in particular as the midterms approach. I mean, who'd have thunk that poor Hondurans, starving, devastated, with no, it's very clear they had no knowledge of the midterm elections and the timing themselves when they started it, that they would become what we call an October surprise, which is like a nasty thing coming from the right to try to skew the election.
That narrative that it might not have been the inception of the caravan, but someone might have seen an opportunity to fan the flames along the way, that makes sense with the growth figures. 160 people leave San Pedro Sula, according to media reports. 3 days later, there's 1,600 at the border with Guatemala. 4 days after that, 3,000 at the border with Mexico. And accounts have put the count in Chiapas, the southernmost state in Mexico, as high as 7,000 now.
Well, you know, I think that also there's a lot of desperate people, you know, desperate people for looking for a way out that are going to starve to death or they're going to get killed. And that includes a lot of Hondurans with it that have been in Guatemala, that are in southern Mexico. You know, some of the media estimates say that only 60%, that 60% of the people in the caravan now are Hondurans, which means, you know, there's Guatemalans, Salvadorans, maybe Mexicans that had joined it. There is zero evidence, as President Trump himself admitted, there is zero evidence that there are Middle Eastern Middle Easterners are terrorists in the caravan. But, you know, we don't really know. What we do know is that it's being used as a potent weapon to terrorize swing voters at the time of the U.S. election. You know, and maybe we can talk a little bit about U.S. involvement in this, because certainly the U.S., Juan Orlando Hernandez, has been regularly celebrated by the U.S. government, both the Trump and the Obama administrations. John Kelly, Trump's chief of staff when he was formerly director of the United States Southern Command, worked closely with Juan Orlando. Surely has to know about his connections, alleged connections to drug traffickers. He's referred to Juan Orlando Hernandez as a great guy and a good friend. Nikki Haley, ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, just yesterday tweeted that the government of Honduras was a friend to the longtime ally or friend to the United States. I can't remember her last language. They're even admitting out loud that this is a government that's friends of the United States. And of course, the U.S. recognized the coup and created the conditions for the coup to stabilize and triumph. We don't have the smoking gun that the U.S. greenlighted the coup, but we certainly have all the evidence that the United States did everything it could to let the coup stabilize in 2009. But it's not just that the United States supported the coup. It's that the United States looked the other way when Juan Orlando ran for a later election illegally. It looked the other way when he stole the election. It certainly could have supported Xiomara Castro's campaign in 2014. They instead supported Juan Orlando Hernandez, the dictator, the now dictator. So the U.S. over and over again has given green light to this illegal dictatorship in Honduras. And so what's interesting is then Trump suddenly says, cut the aid. But he means all the aid as a sort of punishment. But there's been a lot of backtracking from that by various officials, Pence, Pompeo, the U.S. ambassador, different figures saying, and I'd have to say, I can't remember which one exactly, but, you know, like, wait a minute, this is a friend. They're doing things to support the Honduran government by saying it's the political opposition that organized it, for example, because they're worried. I mean, this isn't just about the caravan coming to the United States. It's like people are using this moment to say, yeah, let's get rid of Juan Orlando. And in 2015, there were massive protests in Honduras by middle-class people, led by middle-class people, against Juan Orlando Hernandez after it came out that he and his party had stolen the money from the National Health Service, bankrupting it. So there's the slogan was Fuera Jo, which is Juan Orlando Hernandez out. His initials are J-O-H. And so that's coming out again. So it's not going to be particularly stable for Juan Orlando in Honduras right now. And the U.S. is aware of that, and they want to keep their ally in place. And, of course, those figures in the administration have to deal with like what Trump's choose to say. Now, I want to say something about the question of U.S. aid to Honduras, because Trump has said cut it all. And you want to distinguish between the security aid and the humanitarian and development aid, because the security aid goes directly to support police in Honduras that are committing, and military in Honduras that commit vast human rights abuses. It's highly documented. We know this. And there have been calls in the U.S. Congress since 2011 to say suspend police and military aid to Honduras. We've had as many as 94 members of the House call for that. There are currently 71 members of the United States House of Representatives that have signed on to the Berta Cáceres Human Rights in Honduras Act, H.R. 1299, if you want to look it up online, that calls for an immediate suspension of U.S. Funding for Honduran security forces. So I agree that the funding should be cut for the Honduran security forces, because it goes into killing people. It goes into repression at the Honduran border. It goes into repression in the Honduran streets. It goes into using live bullets to kill people when they try to peacefully protest. We don't even know what percentage. We think it's about $100 million goes to Honduras this year. It's non-transparent. We don't know where the defense funding, even how much it is or where it goes, but it's about $100 million total. And to try to tell how much of that is security aid, somewhere between 30-40% is security aid. The other aid is very complicated. That's money through U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. Some of that money goes into good things. Some of it goes into things like fake civil society groups that then support the government. And there's a very famous one called the Association for a More Just Society that got $6 million this year from USAID. And it basically, you can actually track the United States embassy line in Honduras by seeing the statements from the Association for a More Just Society.
I know you've spent a lot of time, like, meeting with congressional staffers, talking to people in the State Department over the course of the post-coup years. And I'm curious, like, what your impression is of how they perceive the benefits of the U.S. relationship with the post-coup governments in Honduras. Clearly, it's been a highly destabilizing period for Honduras. On the surface of it, you would think U.S. policymakers, no matter what their personal politics, would see that as a bad thing in a place where we have a massive military airbase and where our transnational corporations do business.
Well, you know, there's different interests here, and also how they perceive it and what they're going to say to me is two different things.
Yeah.
I know the State Department more than I know about the White House because I've met with them more, and also I've met with ambassadors a lot. And that's distinct from Congress, and of course, Congress is diverse. So let's start with the State Department. You know, the State Department, that's a giant engine that runs of itself at some level. But, you know, they follow the Obama, now Trump, policies, which is to support the government of Honduras. I mean, of course, the question is, why does the U.S. support this regime all these horrible years? And, you know, it's a Sotocano Air Force Base. There's a military interest there. Sotocano Air Force Base, formerly known as Palmarola, is the only place where they can land the big planes. But it's more like a big geopolitical thing, which we can now, or more recently, seen playing out with this new Cold War with China, which is the U.S. Honduras was always the most captive nation of the United States. The U.S. doesn't have a lot of control over other governments in Central America, and it considers Honduras to be the U.S. backyard, in a famous offensive concept that John Kerry himself repeated again when he was Secretary of State. And so the U.S. wants that big geopolitical control, both for global reasons, but also to protect transnational capitalism in general in the hemisphere, to protect some very specific economic interests, like those investments in the maquiladora apparel production and auto parts and bananas and things like that. But it's much bigger than that. It's more like keeping the whole system of transnational control in place and extractive projects in place. And so that's one piece of it is like,
so here's what's confusing to me. What you're describing is a situation where the U.S. government is aiding and abetting a state of affairs in Honduras where this state is crumbling. It is ceding its monopoly on the use of force to gangs and organized drug smuggling syndicates and becoming destabilized by popular unrest. If Honduras is all the things you're describing, you know, a place the U.S. uses to project force in the region, a way of playing geopolitics, what benefit does the U.S. derive from that kind of corruption and destabilization?
Well, some of this is the military connection, you know. The Southern Command is an engine that runs of itself, and you could see that when certain statements that John Kelly made about certain things he said just so he could get more money for the Southern Command. But also they want to have governments that are loyal to them. And, you know, we can say it's a disaster, and somebody just asked me, is it a failed state? And I don't think it's a failed state if we think a state is something that functions, has a judicial system, and delivers some level of welfare services. Yes, it's failed at that. But let's say this state functions really well for transnational corporations in Honduras. And they have big plans here. I mean, if you look at something called the Alliance for Prosperity in the Northern Triangle, which is a policy position that came out of the migration, quote-unquote, crisis in 2014, you know, it's a big project about, building a new port on the Salvador, on the Pacific side of Honduras, having hydroelectric dams and moving electricity and power generated north, more extractive industries in general. They're just sucking money out of there, you know, out of Honduras all the time and have big long-term plans. And, you know, a couple of years ago, somebody asked me, like, what do you think is going to happen in Honduras? What do they really want? And it would be like, all this profit is sucked out of the environment, and I want to underscore the environmental destruction of these projects as well as the human destruction, and then nobody's allowed to leave. And that's what we're seeing now. You can see that playing out. So this is successful. Now, of course...
Is the government actually trying to prevent people from leaving?
Yeah, they've definitely been arresting people at the border. I mean, they've also... It's very hard to track because the Honduran newspapers are so unreliable. But there's definitely the Honduran Border Patrol. They've also shut the border with Guatemala at one of the key border crossings. So that's definitely going on. We don't know how far they'll go in militarizing it. But it's not like the U.S. government has been happy with the post-coup regimes. They know that it's a disaster, but it's their disaster. They want to hang on to their man. I mean, there's a long history of this. So they know that this is difficult. They know that they can't control it, but this is the best they got, right? They want to hang on to this government that's loyal to them. And, you know, also don't forget that Juan Orlando Hernandez on the Honduran government supported the United States in January in moving the U.S. embassy to Israel, to Jerusalem, and that was a big thing. They're still supporting the United States in backing Taiwan over China. So there are big global things that are going on here that are not even just about Honduras. And also, the United States may not like Juan Orlando. They understand that he's killing people. They know this doesn't look good, but they don't like the alternatives. I mean, they don't want Libre, Libre is not particularly, the opposition party is not particularly left, but it's not going to like the United States. They won't close the military base. They're not anti-capitalist particularly, but they will not be a great ally of the United States necessarily. They'll be independent. The United States doesn't want that, the democratically chosen alternative of the Honduran people. They do not want that. And so what are they going to do instead? They keep trying, you see evidence of them trying to construct some sort of center-right alternative, and that keeps falling apart because there's no base for it within Honduras. You asked me about Congress. Now, Congress is a more mixed bag. There's certainly Republicans that support the Juan Orlando Hernandez government gung-ho. Marco Rubio is the leader of the PAC. In fact, he just came out and said, don't cut the money, which is interesting. He's increasingly the key figure in Congress controlling or bending the ear of Pompeo and the State Department. So you want to watch Marco Rubio of Florida. The Democrats are more mixed. I mean, there are Democrats that say cut the security aid and, you know, don't support this government and did call for a new election December and January. And there are other more centrist Democrats that think just give them more money to fix their economy and, help with police reform, that kind of sort of more centrist argument that usually in the Honduran context means you end up pouring money into the Honduran government to clean itself up. And, you know, this has been going on ever since the coup, especially since 2011, when it became clear that the Honduran police were killing people and were extremely corrupt. The United States, and many centrists will support this, say, give them hundreds of millions, literally at least $200 million to help clean themselves up. And you'll hear that over and over and over again. We're helping them clean themselves up. And, of course, that's contradictory.
All right. Well, Dana Frank, that's all the time we have. I want to thank you so much.
Okay, great.
Dana Frank is a professor emerita of history at UC Santa Cruz. She's been doing research in Honduras for almost two decades. Her forthcoming book, due out November 6th, The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup.